Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. We're talking about home improvement today on the show and taking a closer look at building codes and a couple of guests for you. One of our regular guests, Chad Spate, back with us. He owns Chad's Design Build in Monona and Madison. Chad, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Thanks, Larry. It's always great to be here.
And with Chad is Kyle Bunno. Kyle is the plan review and inspection supervisor for the City of Madison Building Inspection Division. Kyle, great to have you with us. Thanks for joining us.
You're welcome. Thank you very much for the opportunity to speak today.
So, as you listen to these two experts, I hope you'll join in. Are you confused maybe about building codes? What home improvement questions are on your mind? Give us a call. The number is 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or you can send us an email to ideas@WPR.org. Kyle, let's start with you. Tell us about what you do in your job with the City of Madison.
Absolutely. So as you mentioned, I'm the supervisor for plan review and inspection here with the city. What I do is I oversee all the permitted work that happens within the City of Madison. So any building construction that occurs, it could be something as small or simple as a deck being added to the back of a home to a large high-rise building being added downtown. What we do is we administer the state of Wisconsin codes to make sure that plans that are submitted to us meet those codes. Then we issue out permits to contractors or homeowners and inspect that work to make sure that it's done correctly.
So what's your background, or what kind of background, I guess, do you need for this kind of position?
Yeah, so the background is traditionally going to be in construction, as one might expect. I have a degree in engineering, and so I spent several years as a private designer, got a chance to work on it from the private side of things, understand how businesses operate, work with customers, handle that end, and ultimately had the opportunity to move into a public role where I could use some of those skills and talents to make Madison a better place. And it's really been a good fit. And that's the kind of background that you would expect to see here, along with individuals that have worked in the trades.
Yeah, it makes good sense. Let's talk about the Wisconsin Uniform Dwelling Code. What the heck is it?
Yeah, what is that? Right. So Wisconsin, the state of Wisconsin, really has two codes. There's one code called the UDC, or the Uniform Dwelling Code, and that code governs all one and two family dwellings. Right? The other code governs anything that isn't a one and two family dwelling, but we'll focus on the UDC here. So the UDC is a code that Wisconsin implemented in 1980. And since that point forward, it's governed all one and two family construction in the state. So when you go to build a new home, when you go to remodel your basement or attic or put an addition on, those are the standards that the state applies.
Okay, that makes sense. I mean, it's handled differently, though, in different communities, municipalities, is it not, the codes?
Well, I would say that is a misconception, is one of the things that I would say. So the state of Wisconsin, the UDC applies across
everywhere,
the board throughout the state, whether you're doing your work in La Crosse, Appleton, Madison. And what the state does is the state gives municipalities like Madison delegated authority. It means we're an agent of the state. They tell us, Madison, go and enforce our state of Wisconsin codes. Same way they say La Crosse, go and do that, or Appleton, go and do that. For some of the rural communities, the state will handle it. But for any of the larger communities, you're going to have these delegated agents. And so, of course, when you're talking about throughout the entire state, sometimes it's maybe not uniformly applied. That doesn't mean that it's not the same standard, but we certainly try to make sure that we follow all of those standards as closely and as accurately as possible.
So can a municipality, let's say the City of Madison, for example, they'd say, well, this uniform dwelling quote is great, but we wish there was something additional to that code, and we're going to put that in. That's possible.
No, The state actually has a law. So it's a min-max code, which means there are minimum thresholds and maximum thresholds, and you can't deviate from that as a municipality. And it makes sense in a lot of regards because you want to have uniformity. We don't want a contractor who's doing work in Madison to need to do something different in a different locality. And so, you know, it's good to have uniformity across the state. So that way contractors, homeowners, individuals doing work across boundary lines have a uniform expectation.
And yet when you want, and Chad, now talk about it from your perspective, perhaps as a, I know you work in a number of municipalities. Keeping things straight, is it fairly easy or are there things that you need to kind of worry about when it comes to making sure the codes are being followed?
Sure. It's a great question. I mean, you know, I think it's fair to say that the really great thing about working with a municipality like Madison is that there are adequate staff to answer questions. One of the big problems that we run into when there's a gray area and we are working in a smaller community is that it's hard often to speak to the people that can answer your question. And in a place like Madison, there's a team of professionals who are there to help you figure it out. You know, in keeping with what Kyle said, we do see, you know, in a municipality where there is more staff to be able to answer questions and enforce the code, we would expect that they're going to see things or maybe catch things that some contractors might be forgetting or missing. And if you're working someplace where the resources are spread too thin, then some things might get overlooked. But that's not good for anyone, really, when that happens. So we love what we do, and we enjoy working in Madison. Certainly, it's not more difficult to get things done in Madison, I think, contrary maybe to what sometimes you hear people say. But it really comes down to resources, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I was thinking about an addition I wanted to put on, not the current home I have, but the previous home I had, where the house itself was not parallel with the lot line, so that with the addition going out to the length I wanted it, it was going to be about a foot closer to the lot line than the code calls for. So
sure.
The builder I had at the time said, well, this we have to, you can't just go ahead and do this. We need to go and ask for an exception, I believe, to the code.
Right. And so this is more an issue of zoning.
Zoning. Okay.
But still part of the code, which is to say it's not, in this case, it's not how you're constructing the building, but where you are placing the building.
Yes.
And zoning code in every municipality or in any given space has certain rules that are typically standard rules that you follow. There might be, for example, a 6 or a 7 foot side yard setback, depending on the neighborhood and the code. And if a property owner wants to essentially break those rules, they have to ask for permission. And that process is typically to apply for a variance to the zoning code.
Okay, yeah, and in that case, I know the neighbors, I talked to the neighbors and had the neighbors actually write a letter, and then I had to go to the zoning commission, my wife and I, and make our case, and it was approved. But it was a zoning thing, not a dwelling code thing, you're saying. Yeah.
Correct.
Okay. Yep. Well, Therese, so that answered my question. Hopefully it helped other people too. Therese in Menasha, we'll give you a chance. Hi.
Hi. My husband and I are considering buying a piece of land up north that's in the woods, you know, to kind of relax out in nature. And we're having some trouble getting some correct information, so I'm hoping I can get some clarification on that. So we'd like to put something on it small, like a tiny house or a trailer or something like that, so we have protection, but we'd still, you know, like to have something small to enjoy the woods. So we're hearing that some people say, no, you can't build anything like that, or it has to be like the size of a regular house, like over 1,000 square feet. So can you clarify what we're able to build on something like that or not?
Hmm. Kyle, what, where would, this might vary depending on where you are, but comment on that if you can.
Yeah, absolutely. So what you can build on a piece of land is often going to be governed by the municipality or the locality or the county. So, for example, maybe I can't build a gas station in the middle of a residential neighborhood, or the piece of land that you might be wanting to purchase may have some sort of restrictions as far as whether or not dwellings can be placed on it. Maybe they want to preserve the natural habitat there. Presuming that what you want to construct, a home or a cabin, is permissible for the local municipality, there aren't any size restrictions in the Uniform Dwelling Code as far as how small or large your house can be. There are restrictions as far as things that you have to have for life safety purposes, things like exits, natural light, the size of some habitable rooms, but you can build a very small home and meet the Uniform Dwelling Code requirements, which is really what would be applied here.
Teresa, does that help out?
It does help. And where would we find out? I mean, there's a lot of counties and municipalities in the state of Wisconsin. So how would we best research that to find the place that we're looking at we would be able to build something? I mean, what are the resources out there that we could use?
Yeah. Place that I would recommend for you to go would be go straight to the county. So particularly as we get into northern Wisconsin, we start to get to some of the more rural areas where it's less developed and there isn't a municipality that's going to be the delegated authority. The county's going to be the next level that I would go to and talk to some of the county officials, start at the county level, and I would expect that they'd be able to direct you to the appropriate avenues to get those questions answered.
Yeah, that makes sense to me as well. Teresa, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in too. Number to call 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us. The email address is ideas@wpr.org. Our guests today, Chad Spade of Chad's Design Build and Kyle Bunno, who is the plan review and inspection supervisor for the City of Madison Building Inspection Division. I'm Larry Mueller, Jill Nadeau, our producer, Tyler Ditter, our engineer. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Home improvement on our minds today on the show, and taking a look at our Wisconsin dwelling codes and zoning codes with our two guests, Chad Spade of Chad's Design Build, Kyle Bunno of the City of Madison Building Inspection Division. Questions, give a call, 800-642-1234, email to ideas@wpr.org. Dick in Milwaukee has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Dick.
Hi.
What can we do for you?
Okay, Milwaukee. I know there's the UDC, and your guest is, I guess, implied that controls construction. And I've been told that there's certain ordinances that have to be complied with in regard to construction. And I'd like to know the relationship between ordinances and the UDC code.
All right.
Sure.
Kyle, go
ahead. I'd be happy to take that one. Sure. So ordinances are going to be laws or regulations that a municipality passes for a whole host of subjects. The City of Madison, for example, has ordinances that relate to each of the various trades, building, electrical, heating, plumbing. Those ordinances, in a lot of respects, can spell out the things that property owners need to do in order to submit the fees that need to be paid, maybe the documents that need to be submitted that govern how the process works. What they also need to do as a delegated municipality is adopt the state standards. So it gets a little bit technical, but the ordinance basically codifies for that municipality that we adopt the state standards for building, for plumbing, for HVAC. So sometimes a municipality might point you to the ordinance, which then turns around and points you to the state code. Since that's what you're really looking for, that's where we're going to just send you right away.
And Chad, do you, when it comes to permits and, all that thing, as a builder yourself and remodeler, do you typically kind of handle that, or how does that normally work from your side of the fence?
Correct. So typically for our clients, we are making sure that all of the proper permits are pulled and figuring out what's going to be required to successfully implement the project. And so typically when you're working with a contractor, because contractors are licensed and thus have the capability of pulling the permit on behalf of the homeowner and for the work that is happening at the property, we do that. It's also true that a homeowner in many circumstances can also pull the permit for certain work. And for example, there are things that I cannot do on a project. For example, my staff are not licensed electricians, so we do not do electrical work on the job, but we do bring in licensed electricians to work on behalf of our clients. Some municipalities require the contractor to pull all of the permits when the building permit is applied for. Other municipalities, depending on the project, will have the individual trades pull the permit. So for example, the electrician will pull a permit separate from the contractor for, say, a kitchen remodel or an addition or something like that.
Sure.
So, and I think that's a good example of how the ordinance can be different in certain municipalities. As Kyle was saying, you know, the actual process of who pulls the permit can vary in a different municipality, but the same building codes are the rules by which we have to do things like run the wire and frame the building and things like that.
A listener emailed wondering if a no vent gas fired fireplace inserts, are they legal in Wisconsin? Maybe a side question, are they safe and legal in Wisconsin?
Sure. No vent gas fired fireplace. Okay. So I'm going to make some assumptions about this question here, which I would say that the answer is yes. You know, if it's installed correctly and it's installed according to the manufacturer's specifications, gas fireplaces are commonplace in homes. They're pretty popular. And, as long as it's been installed correctly in accordance with the manufacturer's specifications, what we would do from an inspection perspective, and we do this quite routinely because there are many different makes and models, fireplaces, furnaces, water heaters, pieces of equipment that people put in their home. And, you know, fireplaces in a lot of respects, one of that. We're going to make sure that it's done correctly. We're going to make sure that it meets those manufacturer specifications as how it far as how it's been installed.
Rusty in Madison, we'll give you a chance now. Hi, Rusty.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm calling because I am currently a renter living in a dwelling that I suspect is not up to code. I think it may have been a legally converted duplex, like from a single-family home to a duplex. And I guess I'm sort of wondering what recourse I might have as a tenant to be able to leverage potential code violations to get out of a lease that is under circumstances where there are issues with this home. There's, like, for example, there's only one exit. Like, it's all sorts of problems. Just sort of wondering what resources might be available to me as a tenant.
Kyle?
Yeah, so there's you're starting to deviate into a topic that can really start to vary from municipality to municipality. So now what we're shifting our focus to is, are there minimum standards for how housing is maintained in a municipality that renters or occupants can utilize to ensure that those minimum standards are met? And it does dovetail with permitted construction work, because if somebody does something without a permit, without the inspections, without the approvals, there's the possibility that, you know, things like you've talked about, maybe required exits are missing, maybe things aren't appropriate, and those are the things that we always work to catch as a building inspection division. Now, the city of Madison, and you said you live in the city of Madison, we have a minimum housing program where individuals like yourself could contact our office directly, which is what I would have you do. And we can take that concern in and have an inspector come out to your residence and effectively look to see, okay, are the minimum standards being met? Is it possible that potentially unpermitted work has been done that, that maybe makes the space unsafe or needs to be corrected? Does the property owner need to get the necessary permits, make corrections? And so different municipalities may or may not have that type of a minimum housing program. Madison does. I know that Milwaukee does. So yeah, if you're in that situation, I would certainly encourage you to contact your local building inspection division and explore what they might have for a housing inspection section.
All right. There you go, Rusty. Thank you for calling. Maria in La Crosse, it's your turn. Hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. So my question is about a general question about like the home kits. You can buy a kit, which is includes all of the materials necessary for building an entire house. I know Menards offers them. What, if you have an opinion on that in general, and then specifically, they usually have a 24-inch center for studs. Does that meet code in most areas, or would we need to look at adding them to their 16 on center?
Sure. I'll take this one as well. So when we're talking about purchasing pre-manufactured items, the answer is that there's nothing wrong with that, right? You can purchase a home from Menards that has pre-manufactured components that can be put up, that can be demonstrated to meet the code requirements and can be built safe and substantial and be a good home for a person to live in. So there's nothing about that that makes it inappropriate. What you would do from a manufacturer like Menards or anywhere else where you might buy one is, in addition to buying the materials, they're generally going to have a set of plans, and you're going to take those plans to the local municipality that are going to show any modifications that you've made, right? Maybe potentially windows are put in particular locations. What we look for when we go through a plan review are things like, are the bracing requirements met to make sure that it's stable in all the different directions? How's it anchored to a foundation? You know, how is it protected and insulated? Getting to your question specifically about studs being 24 inches on center and whether or not that's appropriate, the answer is, yeah, that can be appropriate. And there are homes that are built with those elements that allow for you to do it correctly. And the walls can be insulated, right? There are many different ways to construct a home. So I think people would be surprised at just the kind of variation that exists. Once you realize that there's a whole host of different ways to do this, then what you really focus on is, okay, you know, have I done it correctly? Have I done it right? And that's where your local official will come into play, and they'll help you look at your plans, hopefully. And if there's something that needs to be adjusted or corrected, that's where we would work with you.
There you go. I was just, you caused me to think back to my youth and my undergraduate years. I spent a couple of summers working for a company, and we built a lot of those homes. I think the homes came from Seney, Michigan, but I pounded a lot of nails and actually kind of paid for my college with that summer work. It was a good time, and I thought we built a pretty good home, to be perfectly honest. I mean, I thought it came, it was a good home, and I thought we did a good job putting it together. Well, you can join in too. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or you can email us, email address is ideas@wpr.org. Wayne mentions that if you're building up north, you need to talk to the township as well as the county. Sometimes they have different codes. But I mean, imagine if you went to the county first, the county would say, well, you're in X township and they have some things you got to worry about as well, Kyle.
Yeah, absolutely. Where I would recommend somebody go to the county is when a township doesn't exist, right? We're really in a rural area. Start small and then work your way up, right?
Oh, so, start small. You know, okay.
Township, if it doesn't exist or you're not in a township, go to the county.
Okay, makes sense. Zach emailed, he's getting a new roof and gutters put on. This is probably something or maybe something for Chad, but Kyle might want to chime in too here. He's getting a new roof and gutters put on. One gutter company uses a very strong unbendable hangers spaced at 18 inches. Another uses standard hangers about 2 to 3 feet apart. The gutter material is the same in both cases, and he's wondering, is it worth spending the extra money for the heavy-duty, closely spaced hangers? It's for 5-inch gutters.
Hmm. Well, that's a great question, and I have to confess, I'm not sure I'm familiar with exactly what it is that one of these contractors is proposing using to hang the gutters. But certainly if he's having a different companies provide different quotes, I would talk to them about things like warranty, because ultimately you're going to want to make sure that however those gutters are installed and attached, that they're going to last a long time and that they're up to the task. And of course, properly installed. So I would ask questions about training of the crews that are going to be installing them and the warranty that they provide.
Yeah, the warranty would be a big thing. There may be a difference in the, the more expensive one may have a longer warranty. You don't know. And so you're smart to ask for sure. Well, let's take some calls here. Laurie in Rosendale, it's your turn. Thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I really appreciate your show.
Thank you.
I was calling. Yeah, thank you. I was calling to find out from your speakers how sustainability is starting to make its way into building codes and how that's impacting sustainability efforts for the state of Wisconsin, and if there's anything that we can do to assist in that regard.
Interesting question. Kyle, start with you.
Yes, sustainability, a great topic. Love to talk about that. From a code perspective, I would say that the principal way that sustainability is addressed is really through the energy conservation codes that the state of Wisconsin has that are part of the UDC. And so really we're talking about how buildings are insulated, the amount that you have, which is just about retaining the heat in the winter and the cool in the summer, how your building performs. Other sustainable topics that individuals love, things like solar panels on buildings, they aren't really incorporated into the code in a mandated way that insulation is. What you get is they become more prevalent as the technology advances, as the cost decreases. And what the code does is it really governs how it gets installed, not that it gets installed, shall we say. So making sure that it's wired correctly from a solar panel perspective, making sure that the electrical grid inside of your home is functioning the way that it's supposed to. From a green perspective, it's a great topic. You know, the codes don't mandate it that much here in Wisconsin, to be honest with you, and even throughout the United States. You start to get overseas into areas like Europe, and the green codes become much more stringent than they are here. But that's not to say that we're not seeing adoption. And I'll let Chad speak to it about it from a contractor perspective, yeah, you know, what he's seen from customers asking for it.
Yeah. Chad, yeah, what about that?
Thank you. It's a great question. And I always like to talk about the fact that, you know, in some respects, the code is the minimum requirement. And so we often have this conversation with our clients, you know, there are certain things we have to do, but there are many things that we probably want to do, whether it's for reasons of sustainability or comfort or just longevity of the building. And while the building codes all help contribute to that, there are certain methods and materials that perform far better than others. And, you know, sometimes a customer will demand those things, but many times a contractor will advocate and recommend those things. So, for example, with respect to insulation, air sealing is really important, you know, making sure that the building does not have a lot of inadvertent air leaking going on the thermal envelope. And the code prescribes that certain things happen, but it doesn't require, for example, on a remodel, that the house be tested to make sure that the contractor has achieved this level of air tightness. And then furthermore, once a house is tight in a really impressive way, then we have to be concerned about bringing in fresh air for the occupants. And again, the code does require that this happen, but it doesn't necessarily require that some of that testing is done, depending on the project. And that's where, you know, as the contractor, we're going to advocate that some of those additional steps be a part of the process, just to make sure that we're doing the best we can with respect to some of these goals.
Yeah, it makes a good question. Again, Laurie, thank you. Ted, in West Allis, your turn. Hi, Ted.
Yeah, hi. Just kind of wondering pros and cons of having a gutter guard system put on the gutters. I see both pros and cons online, and it just gets very confusing.
Hmm. Chad, what's your experience on that?
Well, so generally, my recommendation is if a gutter is extremely difficult to get to safely, and if there are, you know, leaves and other detritus that will end up in that gutter, then that's probably the best circumstance that I would advocate for some form of a gutter guard system. That said, I am not an advocate generally for gutter guards. I know I can get into a little bit of trouble sometimes by saying this, but it's just true that we often see that no system is perfect or foolproof, and that there's still some maintenance required. I'm very concerned about the amount of water that goes over the gutter with some of the gutter guard systems. And we have very torrential rains increasing frequency with changes in weather patterns here in Wisconsin. And so, you know, I want to make sure that those gutters are going to perform, and obviously they have to be clean to perform. So you have a choice to make as a homeowner. If the gutter is reasonably accessible, I would recommend leaving it open and having it cleaned regularly. Obviously, homeowners that are able-bodied and willing to do it can do it, but it's also a service that can be hired out. But that's my general rule of thumb advice on that. Having said that, there are some gutter guard systems out there that seem to do a really good job. And, you know, I have some clients that love them, and then I have clients that have us tear them off of their homes. So it's, you know, one of
There you go. Thank you, Ted, for calling. Appreciate it. And Randy and Madison will give you a chance. Hi, Randy.
Hey, guys. Two questions. Chad, do you ever hire any part-time old guys? sick of driving trucks. But the other thing, I redid my kitchen, tore some walls down, and redid the basement and everything. But now the permit that I got for upstairs, is would that be still considered good for the downstairs if I decide to sell?
Sure, I'll take that one. So when a homeowner or a contractor comes to our office and asks for a permit to do some level of work, we're going to define the scope when we give them that permit. So your permit's going to have a description on it. It's going to say something like kitchen remodel and maybe elaborate on exactly what that means, or basement, bedroom, and bathroom addition or remodel, or we're going to include that scope on it. So your permit is really going to be good for the scope for which it was issued. There are times where homeowners will combine projects together on a singular permit, like we're going to do finish our basement and remodel our kitchen, or put an addition on the back of the house and remodel our living space. Or sometimes they'll do it in separate projects, and that's fine too. But the answer is your permit is good for the scope for which it was issued. And that's going to be true in all of the municipalities. So it's not as though you can get a building permit and then just proceed forward with any amount of work. And the reason we put a scope on it is so that, one, we have an idea of what to be inspecting for, what needs to be done, what needs to be looked at, and that we can make sure that those are the areas that are being focused on, and that somebody who's looking at the record in the future comes back and says that, oh, I see that in 1998, they redid the kitchen. Looks like this was just done a year ago. I don't see any permits for that. Maybe there's a problem with it.
So if, let's say in Randy's case, the permit didn't apply to the basement, but he did it anyway, can he go back after the fact and say, look, I didn't get a permit for this, but the permit, the scope of the permit was not what is not correct here for what I did. Can he have somebody come in and then assess it, or what happens?
Yeah, so I'm going to broaden that topic out just a little bit to basically after-the-fact permitting, right? I've done it. Now I've got to figure out what I am going to do about that. Usually that precedes a sale of a home, or maybe there's something that went wrong, and so we got involved, and we're going to make you get those necessary permits. This is where local municipal discretion comes into play here, as far as how something is going to be treated and what we're going to do. For the city of Madison, and I would hope for a lot of different municipalities, our intent is not to be punitive. We don't want to penalize you per se, especially if it's a homeowner and we think that they've acted in good faith and done something wrong, but inadvertently. If something's been done maliciously, that might be a different story. But what we're going to do is we're going to look to evaluate what we can see with the minimal amount of work needing to be undone, but still need to arrive at the conclusion that what you've done is correct. And so we have had situations where we have had homeowners who have finished off spaces and we've gone to look at them and we've realized you have done things incorrectly. They've used the wrong wiring in the walls. They've plumbed things backwards. and we've had to make them remove everything. And that is a really difficult conversation to have.
I bet.
We've also been in situations where it's been an inadvertent mistake. We've been able to come in. We look at it. We see, hey, things have been done correctly. Or they've been done right. We're not going to make you rip it all out just to be mean. But the starting point is to contact your local official and say, here's the project, right? This is what I wanted to do. I finished off my basement. So let's start the process like we haven't done it. Maybe bring the plans of what you did or what you wanted to do, and then start to have that conversation and be honest and be open, right? These are the things that I used. I hired a buddy. I hired a friend. The worst situation you can put yourself in is to get caught and then start to lie about it. Because the second you start to lie about it, then we as inspectors go, well, how can I be sure that this is done right? I need to see more with my eyes. And that's going to end up costing you as a homeowner.
Oh, good points. Randy, thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Chad Spade of Chad's Design Build and Kyle Bunno of the Madison Building Inspection Division, our two guests today. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Taking a look at home improvement with our two guests, Chad Spade and Kyle Bunno. Thank you so much for joining in today. Lots of emails. I want to get one out of the way here. Jenny in the town of Washington emailed at the end of his driveway. I'm sorry, Jeremy did this. The end of his driveway seems to be the low point of the street. It collects tons of water when it rains and during the spring melt. He's concerned that even if he has his driveway resurfaced, he's still going to have problems with the water collecting because of the slope of the street. Is this something he could bring to his local municipality? And this is probably something that the Uniform Dwelling Code doesn't cover, but what would you do in a situation like this?
Yeah, no, that's a tough situation to be in. Water is a really tricky subject. It's one of the principal things the building code's tried to address is how water infiltrates buildings, because water wrecks buildings. As far as streets, public improvements, it's going to be through your municipality, generally through like the engineering department. If your municipality has one, that's where you would go here in Madison. I know that a lot of municipalities try to put storm drains if your one has it at the low points in streets for this exact particular reason. But I suppose the old adage is water runs downhill. So you have to create a lower point in order to move it away. And your municipality may be able to help you.
Yeah, I think that's a drain might be a possibility, maybe. It's certainly worth talking to the municipality about it. Linda in Sparta, we'll give you a chance now. Hi, Linda.
Hi, yes. I have a question about my windows. I had Anderson windows installed in a new addition in the 1980s. They function fine, but I see on the outside between where the on the casing, between where the vertical and horizontal meet, that corner, they have come apart. The seal has broken. Short of replacing the windows completely, which there's many of them, can those be sealed with some product? And if so, what product? Because I'm afraid of air filtration as far as the quality of air infiltration and also moisture.
Yeah. Chad, yeah, you run into that, I imagine, from time to time.
Yeah, the particular problem that Linda's describing with an Anderson window is not something that I've seen. And a lot will depend on exactly how this window is constructed. What are the materials? I believe in the 1980s, Anderson was still primarily a wood window, the core of it. And so, but maybe this is some sort of a vinyl extruded variation. And of course, like many window manufacturers, there are different lines of window product that they sell. And so the actual materials that are used to construct that window will really determine what your options are. I would recommend reaching out to an Anderson dealer or a contractor with some affiliation with Anderson Windows that will help you to determine if this is something that can be repaired. I will say that, you know, windows, a great window will last 50 years, you know, a modern window. I mean, that would, and of course, some of us still have 100-year-old windows in our homes. But those are often single pane glass windows. And to have a modern window, which a 1980s window would be, it's definitely got a thermopane. You know, it's likely that the seals and the glass are going to start to fail. And at some point in the next 10 years, I would expect windows from the 80s are likely to be a candidate for upgrade. So I hope that's helpful.
Yeah, makes sense. Linda, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Kyle, I'll just go turn to you. I'm sure Chad can chime in on this. What questions should a homeowner ask of their contractor? How do you know the contractor has completed things according to the code or as they should?
Yeah. The way I like to describe it is always a trust but verify. So if you're hiring a contractor to do a project, be upfront about what your expectations are. Make sure that whatever agreement you sign with them, you understand. And then verify, meaning that's where the permitting process comes into play. If you're hiring somebody, they should be a licensed individual. They should be hiring subcontractors who are licensed individuals, and you should be able to ask for, and they should be able to produce the permits that the municipality issues. You should be able to independently call the municipality and see if permits have been issued if you want to do so. And be realistic about the expectations. A lot of times, maybe a contractor who doesn't have the requisite license might ask the homeowner to obtain the permits themselves because they can. And you can choose to do that, but you're also taking on some level of liability. So understand what your liability is, whether or not you're going to be the permit holder or whether or not the contractor is going to be the permit holder. And independently verify with the municipality. When they come to you and say, I'm done, you can call the municipality and say, hey, did the permit get closed out? Did they call for the inspections? Did the inspectors come out and see it? And they'll be able to answer that question really quickly. And it protects you because then you know that not only are they telling you they're done, but the municipality is telling you, yeah, we looked at it. It's good. And that's that independent verification. When somebody shows up and they're just saying, well, I'm done, and you don't know, you're taking them at their word. We like to trust but verify.
No. Chad, anything to add there? I see you nodding in approval with what Kyle was talking about.
I don't know of anything I could add to that. Absolutely.
All right. Well, let's see. We've got Pat in Elm Grove emailed. They have a boiler with copper tubing in the concrete for heating their lower level. Do they need a mixing valve for the 160-degree water that goes into the concrete floor?
You know, I defer to my HVAC contractors for answers to questions like that. I mean, typically, I think the water temperature of a liquid running through a floor, I believe, is typically lower. And I believe when we have in-floor heat, there are often systems that are operating around the 120 degree mark, but that would be typical. That's not to say that, there are systems to help with that particular problem.
Well, here's another different kind of question. Michael in Vernon County asked if whether or not you have experience or knowledge of homeowners who have Amish craftsmen do the home improvements. He'd like to add on a small bedroom and a metal roof. A number of people mention Amish can be effective in keeping doing good work and so forth. And he's wondering if there's typically extra work involved in ensuring that the construction is up to code with something like that. Kyle, any comment there?
Yeah. As far as whether or not the work is done by a contracted crew, an Amish crew, yourself, somebody that you know who has experience, the standards are the same. The standard is the standard. And so that's where the local municipal official comes into play to make sure that it's done correctly. Who you choose is a personal choice, and it should be somebody that you're comfortable with, somebody that you have checked references for, someone that you want to go into business with. And there's no problem with hiring Amish craftsmen to do projects, provided that that's how you want to proceed. It's the municipal official's responsibility to make sure that the work is done correctly and meets the code standards.
And they would have to have codes just like anybody else. I'm sorry, they would have to have permits like anybody else.
Correct.
Yeah. So there you go. Well, I tell you what, we've got lots here. You can join in too, by the way. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Or you can email us. The email address is ideas@wpr.org. Our guests today, and they'll be with us right up until 12:30, as a matter of fact, Chad Spate. Chad owns Chad's Design Build. He works out of Monona and a lot of work in Monona, Madison, and elsewhere. Kyle Bunno is the plan review and inspection supervisor for the City of Madison Building Inspection Division. So you may have questions about dwelling codes or permits, or you just may have a general home improvement question, and I hope you will join in. We'll take a quick look at the news. We'll find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Network, and then we'll be back with Chad and Kyle. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Taking a look at home improvement topics on the show today, Larry Mueller here with my two guests, Chad Spate, owner of Chad's Design Build, and Kyle Bunno, plan review and inspection supervisor for the City of Madison Building Inspection Division. Great to have both of them with us. Questions, give a call at 800-642-1234. Email to ideas@wpr.org. And let's take some calls. Dave in Escanaba, Michigan. We will go to you now. Dave, thank you for calling.
No problem. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to make a comment on the inspectors and the whole permitting process. A lot of people I know, you know, make permits out to be a bad thing. They cost money. But over the years, I've been involved in quite a bit of construction, you know, from a homeowner aspect. And done a lot of stuff without permits, and but ever since you know, 20 years ago or so, a friend of mine built a house. He was in the trade, so we got a lot of help from a lot of different trades, but there was permits for everything. We did the plumbing ourselves, and part of the process for passing the permit was to air up the drains, cap all the drains, apply air pressure with a gauge, and make sure that nothing leaked. Well, we couldn't get it to hold air pressure. We checked and we checked and we checked and could not get it to hold. And we determined that it must be in the concrete. You know, there's drains in the concrete, possibly didn't get sealed. And the inspector came in and he looked and he says, yeah, it's not holding, it's leaking. He says, I would make, you know, a contractor tear out the concrete. He says, but it's your house. He says, if you want me to sign off on it, I'll sign off on it. You know, it's your house. So Scott says, yeah, sign off on it. Well, it took a while to finish the house, but the first time his wife took a shower, yeah, it destroyed the living room ceiling in the basement.
Yeah.
So, you know, and then he was there to protect us, but since it was our house and we were forgiven, you know, willing to sign off on it, you know, he had to fix the drywall. It wasn't that big of a deal, but that was where the leak was.
So inspectors, well, that was in Escanaba, Michigan, but let Kyle, what do you think?
Yeah, I can comment on that. I guess I'm gonna pivot just a bit to the idea of what inspectors do, what our intent is, and what our real hope is. And I think a lot of times people sometimes will look at it and go, "Well, it's an adversarial relationship, right? They're just out here to nitpick things and to pick things that are wrong and to make me feel like I'm, you know, not doing what I'm supposed to be doing." You know, I would hope it's our intent. It's my intent. You know, our goal is to educate people, to make sure that the place that you live, the place that you spend more time than anywhere else in the world, more than likely, is going to be safe for you. And it's going to be done right. And it's going to perform the way that you want it to perform. And we love nothing more than to be able to approve things. Like, my phone never rings with somebody saying, hey, everything is great. Generally, something has gone wrong. And I get to see a lot of different examples of that, unfortunately, from time to time. But we want things to be done correctly for you and also for the next homeowner, too. Right. People think about things as like, this is my home and it is your home, but it's not going to be your home forever. At some point, someone else is going to live in it, and we want it to be right for them, too. And, you know, it's interesting when you start to think about it in those terms.
Dave, thanks again for calling. Let's go to another Dave in Milwaukee this time. Hi, Dave.
Yeah, hi. Taking my call. I just had a kind of a code question. I live next door to a neighbor. Our property shares a driveway. So I've got a driveway. Mine is asphalt. His is gravel. He has no gutters. So every winter when the rain comes down, it's not well insulated, so that that driveway gets covered with ice. Cars slide into each other. Is there any code that says you have to have gutters? Oh. I guess he's grandfathered in on the gravel driveway.
He's grandfathered in on the gravel driveway. Okay. What about the gutters, Kyle?
Yeah, so this is a very typical question. This is we get this one a lot here. And the answer is the code doesn't say you have to put gutters on your house. You do. It's not a requirement the way some other things are requirements. However, I will say it is a great idea, because one of the things that I mentioned before, the quickest way to destroy your house is to let water get into it. And if you can't control where the water is going, it's going to find any crack that exists, and it is going to slowly start to deteriorate your home. And maybe you won't notice it at first, but you'll eventually notice it. And so controlling water through gutters is a really effective tool to maintaining your home in the long run.
Yeah, and you're nodding in agreement, Chad.
Absolutely. Yeah, oh. I mean, I know that you know, some municipalities will help to keep water on a property. In other words, you cannot necessarily flood your downhill neighbor in a way that would. You know, it's one of those very tricky things. Like, I'm not really clear on what the rules are, but we generally, you know, when a caller asked earlier about sustainability, one of our kind of rules of thumb is that, you know, the water that falls on your property, you should try to figure out a place for it to be there. You know, you're not being a good citizen when you're dumping your drain tile, you know, sump pump water out into the street and things like that, or into your neighbor's yard. So we all have to work together to manage things like water. And sometimes there isn't a code that's going to regulate that, but it's just being a good citizen. And of course, when enough people aren't good citizens, then we end up having to make rules to deal with it. So,
Elliot in Milton emailed, he's building a new home and has a question about properly air sealing the envelope. He has the sill seal foam under the bottom plate as required. Should he tape the bottom of the OSB sheathing over the bottom plate and over foundation foam? And should he tape the OSB sheathing joints? He's also interested in putting a foam board on the outside of the sheathing. Would you house wrap over sheathing, then foam, or both?
So these are some great questions. And, you know, As we were discussing earlier, the particular materials that are used can meet the code and yet in a certain combination, it might not end up working out well for the building. So for example, OSB is a vapor barrier, and it can create a problem on buildings because we, in Wisconsin, we typically install a vapor barrier on the inside of an exterior wall. And what you want to have on the outside of the wall is a good water barrier that allows vapor to escape, but keeps any water from getting into the wall. And so it's hard to, you know, just give an answer to the question, though they're good questions, because at the end of the day, we want to have a good water barrier. So typically, I mean, you can do it. You can put that. I would recommend that he put up some sort of a rain screen like Tyvek. Generally, I would say it's probably best placed right on the on that OSB sheeting, and then the insulation board would go on the outside of that. But depending on all of the details, for example, where the windows and doors are going to be placed. Because they have to be flashed properly to that Tyvek or to the rain screen. So all of it has to work together as a system. And hopefully that helps.
Thanks again for that question, Elliot. Matthew in Warren, Illinois, it's your turn. Hi, Matthew.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I did a complete restoration on an 1880 farmhouse. And I don't know if you know, water can cause a lot of damage, but I've been, I think I did too good of a job of sealing up the old window frames on the outside, specifically where the trim comes down to the windowsill. The trim has been rotting. And I saw some advice in some books about you drill a couple of drip holes there where the vertical comes down to the sill, and you can put in these little brass filters so that bugs can't get in, but any water that gets in there can come out. I can't find any of those creatures anywhere, and I don't know if that's the modern approved method, if there's some other way I can put in something that'll let water come out that gets trapped behind the facing without rotting out the windowsill, and or should I also replace those windowsills with a PVC or something that is more water resistant?
Well, those are great questions, and certainly you're on to some of the solutions there because, for example, it's not uncommon for us to wrap a windowsill, particularly on an older home, with an aluminum cladding to just, you know, be able to help accommodate the flow of water often to the other side of a wood frame storm window or something like that. You do need weep holes to allow water to get out that can sometimes get into a window assembly like that. So I'm not familiar with the brass screen that you, the plug that you referred to, but I can imagine what you're describing. And that, that could also be a perfectly good approach. But, you know, I think either putting in a small spacer that allows the water to get out or some well-positioned weep holes, something that allows you to protect the wood where you put those holes, because obviously water is going to be passing through those holes. And so you're going to have to take some pains to make sure that you just don't have, you know, a lot of ongoing rotting where you have allowed the water to pass. But it is a common challenge in an older home.
Thanks, Matthew, for calling. Appreciate it. Is Stephen, I should say, wanted to make sure we remind homeowners about the importance of getting lien waivers from contractors. And maybe contact, you know, somebody might say, well, what's a lien waiver and why do I need one? Want to comment on that?
Sure. So it is often in a contract with a homeowner that if the contractor is not paid for their services, they can file a lien. And so often a homeowner has agreed to allow that to happen. They do have to contractually agree to it for the contractor to have that right to pull the lien. But then once a homeowner has paid for services, if they have not obtained a lien waiver, it starts out as a partial lien waiver on a larger project. And then when the final payment is made, it's a full lien waiver. What can happen is that if the contractor has not paid their subs or suppliers, then that individual can come and file a lien against the homeowner. And even though the homeowner has paid the contractor has not done their job to then pay those other people. And that's a very unfortunate situation. And so the way that you protect yourself as a homeowner is to obtain those lien waivers as the process unfolds.
Makes sense. Dennis in Two Rivers, your turn. Hi, Dennis.
Hi. I know when you were talking about not diverting water to neighbors' lawns, it's also can be overwhelming for a sewer system if people have water draining or going into a sewer system, because that's what happens in Milwaukee. It's even happened in Two Rivers. So just wonder about having available space for rain barrels or something else to hold water temporarily.
Well, that's a great point, and I know Kyle can probably speak to this. It's often not legal to dump water that is from a sump into the drain. And of course, what often happens in municipalities, because I serve on the Public Works Committee in Monona, and we're constantly measuring how much water is actually leaking into the sewage system through various, you know, little cracks and whatnot that are in the infrastructure underground, because there's some of that that's going on. And but it is true that it is often illegal. And even if it isn't illegal, it's a really bad practice to overwhelm our sewage systems with anything other than the water that is flowing through our toilets and drains.
Yeah. Kyle, something to add there.
Yeah, everything that Chad has listed out there is correct. You simply don't want to be putting stormwater down a sewer system, because just like any pipe, when there's more water and more material going through it than it can handle, what happens is it backs up. And our sewer systems are designed to handle specific loads related to water that's being flushed down the toilet and run down the sink. It's not designed to catch all of the rain that falls from the sky. And if that gets into the system, it overwhelms the pipes, which means that it backs up into the low homes and it can really do a lot of damage. So when you are developing a piece of land, when you're developing a property, if you're putting on a new shed or a garage, take a moment and think about where that water that fell into the ground is going to go. Rain barrels are great ideas. Rain gardens as well. Even just plantings in your lawn, right? Plants need water. They will suck that up. Trees, great examples of all different ways to manage stormwater. But there is not one solution that works everywhere. It's a combination of a lot of little things that work together.
And when you get rain like we had, how many years ago was it now? A couple, 3 years ago, I'm living in Madison. I mean, what, 3 years ago was it? Oh my goodness me. What a mess.
Yeah, we were involved in going through a lot of homes that had a lot of damage as a result of more rainwater than we ever thought that we would take in a short amount of time. And it doesn't appear to be slowing down anytime soon.
No, it's more to look forward to, for sure. Anne Marie emailed. She has a problem with a structure between the old an old garage and a new house. Main entry into the new house is through the breezeway. Now it seems she needs to put in a proper foundation after the fact. Her original permitted drawing did not show a foundation. What should she do?
Okay, I can answer this one a little bit. This is a difficult situation to be in, because what you really have is you have a garage that was detached, and now we're connecting it to a house that's heated. So we have an unheated garage and a heated house. And the heated house has got an insulated foundation so that it's not moving up and down when the ground freezes in the winter. The garage is unheated and doesn't have a insulated foundation and will move up and down. So now we've taken two things and we've connected them together. One moves and one doesn't. How does somebody approach that? Realistically, what you're going to end up doing is you're going to insulate the foundation for the connection here to make sure that that's not moving. And you're going to allow for the connection to the garage to basically slip so that as the garage moves up and down, it doesn't wreck the breezeway and the home. And yeah, that's a tough situation. And that would be, you know, hopefully something that would get caught at the plan review stage that your permitting official would look at and identify. But it's a tough situation to be in for sure.
And then kind of expensive one, unfortunately for sure. Well, this has been a lot of fun and really interesting to me, and I know it has been to our listeners. I want to thank you both for taking time to be with us today. It's been a pleasure. Kyle, it's been great to have you. I hope we have a chance to do this again. And Chad, I know we'll see you in a couple of months again. Thank you so much, both of you.
Thanks, Larry.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Chad Spade is the owner of Chad's Design Build. Full disclosure, he's also, I should mention that Chad's Design Build is one of Wisconsin Public Radio's many business sponsors. So that's great, too. Kyle Bunno is the Plan Review and Inspection Supervisor for the City of Madison Building Inspection Division. I want to mention again, the Wisconsin Science Festival is coming back this fall, October 21st through the 24th. And I'm excited that I get to be part of a talk about mushrooms in our state. I've got a panel of five experts, and we will be exploring the roles that fungi play in supporting and threatening important Wisconsin habitats and industries. So you can join me on October 23rd. For a closer look at this wild and robust world of mushrooms, the good, the bad, and the ugly, I call it. Registration is free, and you can attend in person or you can attend online. Just go to wisconsinsciencefestival.org. I think it's at 1 or 1:30. Anyway, wisconsinsciencefestival.org. Well, tomorrow, Patty Nagai comes back to talk about putting your garden to bed for the winter and help with your other gardening questions. In the meantime, thanks for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller.